Welcome in this study to Counseling Youth, and this is Counseling Youth 1. We'll be having another quarter of it later on in the year, but this is part 1. We're going to deal tonight with the problem of suicide and then finding true love. Let's consider first the problem of suicide. It's the second leading cause of death among teenagers. Statistics tell us that every 28 seconds, someone attempts suicide. It's the second leading cause of death for people between the ages of 15 and 24. It's often difficult to identify teens who are thinking about suicide, they're contemplating it, because teenagers in particular, in general, they're often reluctant to reveal the problems they're going through in their mind and in their inner thoughts. Some of the signs that might alert a parent, a teacher, pastor, youth leader, friend, to a possible suicide attempt, these might be some telltale signs. First of all, if there's been a previous suicide attempt, and then if they're threatening to commit suicide, or if they talk a lot and they're obsessed about dying, or if they're cleaning out a locker at school, they're giving away what they've got like they're preparing for death, that's a telltale sign. If they're really depressed and withdrawn, just drawn within themselves, that's another sign. And then when there's a sudden change in behavior, maybe violent behavior, and just not the same person that you've known for years and years, well, that may be a telltale sign of contemplating suicide. Maybe moodiness and withdrawal, increased risk-taking, like they don't care whether they live or die. Especially if they draft a suicide note, that's always an indicator to be careful and do what you can to stop what might be the inevitable. And so these are problems of suicide. Notice the causes of it. There are social factors. For instance, the change in moral climate is one thing. In America, I mean, it's like human life doesn't matter anymore. We abort babies like they're nothing when they're human beings. And so there's a change of moral climate in America. There's the high mobility of American society, how people are moving around a lot. They can't get settled in life, and that's a factor. And then the high divorce rate. A lot of times young people will blame themselves because their mother and dad can't get along and are talking about divorce, or they are divorcing, when really it's not the young person's fault. It's a problem between the mom and dad. And then another factor is the frequent use of alcohol and other drugs. If a person drinks enough alcohol or they take drugs, it bends their mind somewhat. And a person under the influence of alcohol or drugs may do something they otherwise wouldn't do. And then in our society, another factor of suicide is glorifying violence in the mass media, video games and all that, television, violence. And then, of course, there's the availability of guns, but I've always said this, a gun never killed anybody unless somebody pulled the trigger. There's nothing evil about a gun, but guns can be misused. And then there's the high suicide rate there is already. And if some commit suicide, others see it and they get in their mind to do it. So the sources of support become shaky when there's a divorce and you only see one parent, or you shifted back and forth between a couple of parents and different marriages. Sometimes that leads toward feelings of suicide. And then when the foundations get shaky, young people turn to two things mainly: alcohol and drugs to find comfort. Now, those agents, when you mix it with a teenager's romantic notion of death, a society that glorifies violence and easy access to the means of suicide, then that can spell death for more and more adolescents. Suicide begets suicide. A suicide attempt or completed plants the idea of self-generated death in the minds of others. Now, suicide in the family pulls other family members closer to the possibility of that option. But beyond the social factors are personal factors. Why do teens try to kill themselves? Well, the following are among the reasons. One thing is family disruption. That increases a person's stress, and there's sometimes a sense of alienation, sometimes parental rejection, and it can lead to thoughts of suicide and even depression. And then another thing about it is escape. Most suicidal persons want to escape from what they think is an unlivable, intolerable situation. Two important ingredients for those who begin to think about taking their lives are, number one, hopelessness, and the other is faulty reasoning. In fact, mental illness can be involved, not always, but sometimes it can be. The suicidal person may intend on escaping a painful illness, maybe some punishment is coming, some humiliation, and maybe just the weight of burdens, mental burdens and emotional burdens, escapes the idea. And then there's the idea of loss. For some, the death of a parent or a close friend or a loved one seems too painful to bear, and some cannot deal with loss in the right way. Then another factor is guilt. Suicide is often the individual's attempt to take control of the punishment for sins or maybe some other misdeed that person that he or she feels guilty about. And then there's attention. A suicide attempt grabs attention like few other things. So people are startled and they're concerned and guilty and puzzled. And suicide attempt can be a desire for attention and also a desire for help. Could be to draw attention. It could be to try to move someone to help them. Then another factor is manipulation. Manipulation by attempted suicide is used by children against parents. Sometimes it's used by husbands against wives, or girlfriends against boyfriends, or workers against co-workers, trying to manipulate somebody by threatening to commit suicide. Another factor in suicide is revenge. The suicide of revenge is normally directed toward a lover, a parent, or a parent figure. Those are the three main areas where revenge is usually directed. Another factor is impulsiveness. Adults often display a casual disregard for their life and safety, and sometimes they exhibit a fascination with the unknown and with death. Sometimes people do things on impulse, which is not a wise thing to do. And then there's expression of love, a factor. If a romantic relationship is broken up, maybe a divorce, one divorces the other, and there's a death of a loved one, sometimes it affects a person to think to the point of contemplating suicide. Maybe their emotions are numbed, or their perceptions are distorted, and their hopes for the future are destroyed. Let's look, secondly, at the effects of suicide. Very few young people contemplate suicide, and they do not realize when they do the effect that suicide can have on them around the grief and the planting of seeds of destruction. My dad had Parkinson's disease, and at about 54 years of age, my dad took his life. He went through pain day and night. He had a headache that would not go away, and I wish my dad hadn't done that. But I wasn't in my dad's shoes. I don't know what he went through with. And so families are affected by suicide. I'll tell you how it affected me. I was bitter at God for approximately 2 or 3 months. I didn't understand why God couldn't have somebody there to stop my dad from doing what he did. Well, that wasn't any good, and that didn't last very long. Because I was a miserable man, being bitter at the God who saved me, devised the plan of salvation, and saved my soul. And that really troubled me, and I couldn't rest very well, knowing that I was bitter at God. There are definite effects of suicide on others that young people don't even think about when they're getting ready to take their life. First, there's grief. Inevitably, the living never blame the dead. They blame the living. A lot of times they just simply blame themselves. And then there are seeds of destruction that are sown. Suicide not only destroys the person that takes his life or her life, but what it does, it plants the seeds of destruction in the lives of those around. Parents, siblings, friends, classmates. In other words, if a person commits suicide, whether they know it or not, they're encouraging somebody else to do it. In other words, those closest to the suicide victim are at a higher risk of attempting suicide than others are. Let's look thirdly at the biblical perspective of suicide. The Bible has many accounts of individuals that they had great difficulties, they had a load to carry, they endured great burdens, and they contemplated suicide. Psalm 73:14. The psalmist said, "For all the day long have I been plagued and chastened every morning." In Job 3 and verse 3, it says, "Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, there is a man-child, arrive." And then over in Job chapter 3, verse 11, he said, "Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly?" In the Bible, there are a number of suicide accounts. One of those is Samson. Samson killed himself along with all the Philistines in the temple of Dagon. There's another, King Saul. He fell on his own sword. Instead of allowing himself to be taken prisoner by the Philistines, his enemies, he fell on his own sword and committed suicide. Ahithophel was a counselor to King David. Ahithophel hanged himself. There's another named Zimri. When he saw his royal city had fallen to the enemy, the king of Israel set his palace on fire all around him, and he stayed in the midst and died in the flames. Another that committed suicide is Judas Iscariot. Judas was one of the 12. You remember, he betrayed Jesus, and he had so much guilt because of what he had done. Later, Judas hanged himself. So the scripture over and over affirms the sanctity of human life. And we're not to take our lives. That's the Lord's prerogative. It's the Lord's to give life, and it's the Lord's prerogative to take away life. So in light of the principles of the Word of God, suicide is not the Lord's way of leaving this world. John 16:33 says, "These things have I spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." Is suicide an unforgivable sin? I had a dear preacher friend that took his life. And I was at a store one day, and I was telling somebody about it. And there's a fellow there I didn't know. And he looked over and said, "Well, I guess he went to hell, didn't he?" I looked at him and I said, "Sir, you obviously don't understand what the Bible teaches. Is suicide the unforgivable sin?" No, certainly not. It's not that act that Jesus identified as the unforgivable sin. When you read about it in Matthew 12:31, many feel like that suicide is a sin there's no forgiveness for. Now, they obviously misunderstand the gospel of grace. We're saved by grace. We're kept by grace. We're going to heaven by grace. It's all the grace way. The only sin that keeps one out of heaven is the sin of unbelief, simply not trusting Christ and his work personally. And the inability to confess suicide as a sin is not a real issue. God's forgiveness gives us a position. As his child, he dealt with all of my sin, past, present, and future. Now, if he dealt with my past sin, my present sin, and my future sin on the cross, how could suicide stop me or you from going to heaven? If suicide's a sin, he's already dealt with that at Calvary. I'm glad God's redemption and God's grace takes care of it all. So if salvation depended upon confessing every sin committed as a believer, no one would be qualified to go to heaven. Let's look at the response to the problem of suicide. Sometimes, in fact, most of the time, there needs to be a professional evaluation of that person. Now, if you don't do that, if you take it lightly, and the young person attempts to take his life or her life, and you knew that might would happen, you may be legally responsible. So if any time during the counseling process you suspect that a young person may be committing or contemplating suicide, don't leave that young person alone until they're in the care, of course, going through their parents, of a mental health professional. So the professional evaluation many times is necessary. What do we need to do? Well, we need to listen. Always take every indication seriously when a person's thinking about suicide. Never mock, never challenge a young person's statement about attempting suicide. Oh, you'd never do that. Well, you don't know what they would do. You better take the thought of suicide on their part as a very serious matter. Listen carefully. Listen sensitively. Listen patiently. And take no chances with any young person. Not only listen, but empathize. You see, the primary power you have in dealing with a person talking about suicide is your relationship with that person. And maybe the way you show interest and concern will help divert them from making an unwise decision and taking their own life. It pays to pray for that young person and also to stay in touch with them. Don't leave them alone too long. Stay in touch. Then the fourth thing to do, or the third thing, is to affirm. It's important that we realize that these young people are valued and loved, and what we've got to do is confirm that to them. They're valuable to God. They're valuable to us. They're loved. They have capabilities and gifts. There's potential that they can't let go to waste and end. So there has to be an affirmation. Also direct, work on a relationship. And the best thing anyone can do in helping a potentially suicide victim, a young person, contemplate, is have a healthy relationship with them. Befriend them and let them know that you're their friend. Work on relationship, especially in the home, moms and dads and the children. And then build self-worth. Reinforce the child's successes. Well, they may have failed in this area or that area, but don't major on their failures. Reinforce their successes and remind them that they're loved and they're accepted. Another thing we can do is instill hope. Suicidal persons need hope. They're preeminently persons with no hope. And then we need to foster communication. There's a large percentage of youth, even Christian youth, say they can't talk to their parents about the things that matter in life. Well, try to show respect to their opinions, no matter what they are. Then teach coping skills. Teach them how to cope. Tell them how maybe somebody else coped with the problem and how they can cope with it. And then what you do is, as well, focus on the available resources. They don't realize all the resources there are today to help them cope. There's information on the internet. There are good books written by Christian authors and all kind of things that can help them. And, of course, the local church is there to help them. Then develop a plan of action. Set up some concrete steps to help that young person, a 1, 2, 3, 4. Let's set our mind to do these things and encourage them to do it. Develop a plan of action. And then enlist that young person in participating in preventing a suicide attempt. Good thing to do is get them involved in the youth group, in the church, and some things like that. And then if they need help, make sure they get it. Well, let's talk for a few minutes about true love. There's first the problem of finding true love, real love. I'm not talking about puppy love. I'm not talking about some superficial thing. I'm talking about genuine, deep, strong love that lasts for a lifetime. Many young people struggle to understand what love is. They don't know how to find it. They're geared too much by their hormones, and they really don't understand what love is. They mistake friendship sometimes for love, or sometimes they'll even mistake lust for love. Many young people are willing to give almost anything to experience love, particularly somebody from the opposite sex. And so far too many set themselves up for heartache and disappointment. They think that what they think is love is not really genuine love. It turns out to not be what they thought it would be. What are the causes of not finding true love? Well, teens, first of all, don't know what love is. They confuse love with emotions and experiences, and they really don't have a good basis to evaluate a relationship. You know, in sex education, they tell them how to apply condoms, but they don't tell the young people what they most need to hear, what will be most effective in saving them from two things, disappointment and disease. And that's a biblical understanding of true love. I want to talk to you about what it isn't and what it is. Well, what it isn't, real love is not the same as lust. They're just not identical. Real love isn't the same as romance. Now, romance can be wonderful, but it's not necessarily love. Romance is a feeling. Real love is much more than a feeling. And then real love is not the same as infatuation. What an infatuation is a fascination, an intense interest in someone of the opposite sex. Now, what's more is you sometimes find yourself held captive. You have feelings for one person, you think it's love, and then you have the same feelings for somebody else, and you try to say it's love. Well, no, that's simply a fascination. That's all it is. And when people talk about falling in love or love at first sight, normally what they're talking about is simply an infatuation. Infatuation can be overwhelming. It can be a feeling that just overtakes you, but that's not necessarily real love. So that's kind of what love isn't. And by the way, let me mention something else. Real love is not the same as sex. A lot of people associate sex with love. They have relations with another physically they shouldn't have. Well, they think that's love. If they have intimacy before marriage, they think that's love. What's the difference between love and just sex? Well, one of these is love is a process. Sex is an act. Love is learned. Sex is instinctive. Love requires constant attention. Sex takes no effort. Love takes time to develop and mature. Sex needs no time to develop. Love requires emotional and spiritual interaction, but on the other hand, sex requires only physical interaction. Love deepens a relationship, but sex operating alone dulls a relationship. So real love isn't the same thing as sex. What is real love? Well, let me give you three kinds of love. Someone said there are three types, three ways of behaving that people routinely label as love. Let me say, first of all, there's a love if. Love if. If you're a good child, daddy will love you. If you get good grades, mama will love you. If you act or dress a certain way, I'll love you. If you meet my expectations, I'll love you. Well, that's loving if. So essentially what it is, the love is offered in exchange for something the lover wants. Its motivation is selfish. What it's out to do is get something in exchange for love. Love if always has strings attached. For instance, if a person, sometimes two young people be dating, and one will say, well, if you want to date me, have physical relationship with me. Well, that's saying, I'll love you if, and that's no good. There's strings attached to that. In fact, a lot of marriages don't last because they were built on that kind of love. Loving if. Then there's love because of. That type of love, it's better than the love if, but love because of reflects attitudes, usually unexpressed. For instance, I love you because you're beautiful. I love you because you're rich. Or maybe I love you because you give me security. I love you because you're so funny. I love you because you have such a big house. Well, that love may sound pretty good, but we want to be loved for what we are and what we do right. Love because of. It certainly be preferred to the if kind of love. The if kind of love has to be earned constantly and requires a lot of effort. Well, here's the problem. I mean, the love because of is better than the love if, but here's the problem with it. What if somebody comes along who's prettier, or funnier, or wealthier, or things like that? If such things are the reason another person loves us, then that love's going to be temporary. It's not going to last. I want to give you the best kind of love. It's not love if, love because of, but it's love, period. I believe that's the love of John 3:16, where it says, God so loved the world. It says you can't do anything to turn off my love. I love you, period. I just love you. It knows others' faults, and yet love, period, accepts that individual without demanding anything in return. There's no way to earn that kind of love. And by the way, one can't lose it either. And the reason is there are no strings attached to it. Love, period, is a giving relationship. Love if is certainly inferior. Love because of, well, it's better than the first option, but the best option is simply love, period. It's about giving. It's not about getting. It's about giving. You know the other's faults, and yet you accept that individual without demanding anything in return. No strings attached. Now, let's look at the biblical perspective of true love. Love, period, is the only biblical love. According to the Bible, true love is evident when happiness and health and spiritual growth of another person is as important to you as your own. The Word of God says, love your neighbor as yourself. It doesn't command us to love our neighbor more than ourselves. We're to love God more than we love ourselves, but we're to love our neighbor, our boyfriend, girlfriend, or our mate in marriage, as we love ourselves. Ephesians 5:28 says, so men ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. What does it mean to love our own bodies as the scripture commands? Now let's go one more verse. Ephesians 5:29 says, for no man ever hateth his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord cherisheth the church. God's definition of true love means to nourish and cherish. Let me say that again. His definition of true love is to nourish and to cherish. That is to protect or cherish, to provide for, or to nourish. And in the areas of happiness and health and spiritual growth in another person. So you do it in the same way you protect and provide for your own happiness, your own health, and your own spiritual growth. Now I want to say this, and young people need to understand this. True love will not pressure a boyfriend or a girlfriend to have sex outside of marriage, because that does not protect that person. It doesn't protect their happiness. It doesn't protect their health. It doesn't protect their spiritual growth. So agape love, or just love, not because of, but the kind of love that God has is that love that says, I love you in spite of all the weaknesses I see in you. That's the love we need toward one another. It reaches beyond to a willingness to give when the loved one's not able to reciprocate, whether it be illness, failure, or any other weakness. It's a love that can repair bonds severed by unfaithfulness, indifference, or jealousy. The best example of that is God himself. Let's look at the response to the problem of finding true love. First, we need to listen to these young folks. Listen to them. You might ask some questions like, what is true love? Have you ever been in love? Do you think a man and a woman knows if they're in love? Or you might say, well, what do you think about being in love and what it feels like or looks like? That'll get the young person thinking. And then propose some questions and listen to what they have to say. Another thing to do is empathize. So the empathetic adult will be careful not to dismiss or to degrade a young person's feelings on this subject. What we need to do is take that young person seriously, and when we handle them carefully. Then our response should be to affirm. Parents and other adults concerned with the youth, they need to strive to communicate acceptance, affection, and appreciation to them at every opportunity. We want our young people to tell us how much they appreciate us. Do you not think that they want us to tell them how much we appreciate them? We ought to do that at every opportunity. And then another thing we need to do is direct. Take every opportunity to model a biblical concept of love to the young people in your life. Pray with them about their love life. And, you know, they may be getting to that age to where they want somebody to date. And that's normal and that's natural. Well, pray with them about it. Pray for the Lord to send the right one along. And encourage them to involve the Lord in their search for true love. To ask God to show them who they're supposed to date. And really, beyond that, who they're supposed to marry. Then seek teachable moments. During those moments, you can communicate a biblical concept of love to those young people. And when you do, they'll know what they're looking for in relationship, and they might be more likely to recognize it when it comes their way. The last thing to do is to enlist. And here are some questions that you might could ask. Do we both know Jesus personally? Is Jesus first in that relationship? Can we be honest with each other? Do we accept each other completely? Now, we're talking about questions that young people need to face between themselves. Do we have our parents' approval? Then do we have control over our sex lives? Do we share common values? You might ask, can we handle disagreements? If your marriage is going to work, you're going to have to handle disagreements. Can we handle being apart? Are we really friends? Are we really a whole people? But here's the clincher. Here's the most important of all these questions. Am I willing to commit myself for life? It seems today like a lot of young people are married. They think it's just some kind of a trial, and they'll get hooked up with this person, and when they get tired of them, they'll just find another one. All kind of dating things on the internet and places to find people. I want to tell you, that's kind of scary to me to think about that. Total strangers from God knows where. But what you need to do is ask the Lord for that one that he has for you to date and finally to marry. Now, who you date may not be the one you marry, but your first date may be the one you'll stay with for months and for years, and that may be the person the young person will marry. But here's the question. Am I willing to commit myself for life? Marriage, the ideal of marriage, is one man, one woman for a lifetime. That's God's ideal. So cooperation among these principal influences in a teen's life is vital to the development of several things. The main thing, strong, healthy relationships. First, a relationship with God, and then healthy relationships with others. And the teenager needs definite convictions about love. As I said, love is not the physical sexual act. Love is not some kind of infatuation, but love is giving yourself, your life, to someone else and committing for a lifetime. I hope this lecture has been helpful. Be sure and do your outside work and turn it in on time. God bless you.